One of the most watched responses to the corona outbreak so far has been the Wonder Woman star, Gal Gadot, accompanied by a whole raft of other celebrities, folk like Natalie Portman and Will Ferrell and Mark Ruffalo, and they're all singing together, phrase by phrase, the John Lennon song Imagine, you might have caught it. And in the intro to this, Gadot described how this virus that we're going through has brought the whole world as one together, and how this song, the Imagine song, captures humanity's hope of a world united. And you know the verse, it goes, "You may say that I'm a dreamer, I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one." And I'm guessing not all of us would agree with John Lennon's program about how this dream is going to come about. But I guess all of us long for this vision, don't we? Of a world united together as one. In fact, I guess one of the reasons why some people were so upset about Brexit in this country was that the European Union was supposed to unite the nations. It was supposed to prevent Europe from ever going to war again. And for many, Brexit was ending this great hope. And that was part of the trauma behind it. And different people, we look to different vehicles perhaps to bring about this hope of a united world. Some of us through technology, some of us through the Olympic movement or communism or through the UN. And today what we're going to do is we're going to consider God's strategy for bringing about a united world. And it's a strategy that it starts very small, a bit like a mustard seed, the smallest seed in the garden, and then it grows and grows to become a big tree that fills the whole garden. Now, we're in John 17, as we just had read. And we get to listen in John 17, to Jesus praying to his Father on the night before he dies. And I've mentioned in previous weeks that this is a prayer where Jesus really pulls back the veil and he lets us in on God's great and glorious plan for his world, not least so that we can lean in and find out how we can get involved. And in the final section of the prayer, which is today's bit, verses 20 to 26, we discover that Jesus wants his followers to be united in love. It's on your sheets or on the screens. So let's look. Hopefully you've got the verses there on your service sheet. Verse 20, he says, "I do not ask for these only." So Jesus' plans for this united world begin with actually 11 people there in a room with Jesus. But his plans don't end with the 11. "I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word." So Jesus here, he's looking across the world and down the ages to all who are going to ultimately receive the apostles' message. And this is Jesus' prayer, verse 21, "that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us." If you know the Bible storyline, the Bible describes how when our first ancestors rebelled and they crashed out of fellowship with God, we also crashed out of fellowship with one another. And that's the reason why this world is so full of fracture lines and scars and tensions. And Jesus has come in part to heal those fractures and to remake a broken world. And did you notice when I read the verse that this oneness with each other there in verse 21 flows out of our first being reconciled to God our Creator and being caught up in these eternal relationships within God? Let me read again. "That they may all be one," 21, "just as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us." So I was thinking of a way of illustrating this. It's a little bit like as if humanity are the spread out like spokey dokies around the edge of a bicycle wheel. If you don't know what spokey dokies are, well, this is a little insight into my childhood. And if you don't know, you've really missed out because they're a lot of fun. And the secret of spokey dokies being united together is not each of us as spokey dokies trying to reach out and reach the others all around the rim of the wheel. No, the secret of all the spaky daities coming together is all of us coming back into the centre, one by one, into fellowship with God, the centre of the wheel. And as we do that, the side effect is that we're then brought back into closeness with one another. Because as soon as God is my Father, then automatically I'm brought back into fellowship with all the other brothers and sisters who are in the same family. And I guess for lots of us, if we're believers, we know this in experience. We know what I'm talking about. Perhaps you've had the experience of going to a new city, or you're flying halfway around the world, and you find you have closer bonds, you have more in common with a believer who you've just met than perhaps those closest with you back home who don't yet share your faith. I love this story which the writer Gail Irwin writes, tells about this miracle in action. So when Gail was growing up, there was a man in the town who was notorious for drunkenness and violence. And this guy, Jake, would sometimes just pitch up at the church. And if he did so, it was always with bad intent. In fact, sometimes he'd come just to pick a fight with the ministers. I'm quite glad he doesn't live in Greenwich. And one Wednesday night, Jake came along to church. It was a special week of meetings. And remarkably, he didn't want to beat anyone up. And he actually came and he listened to the whole message. And that night, something happened. And it all clicked for him. And he realised that he needed Jesus, and he put his faith in him, and he received God as his Father. And then the next night at church, there was another meeting, and the minister stood up and he asked if anyone wanted to share what God was doing in their lives. And Jake stood up in front of everyone and he said, "Look, I've got something to say. Last night when I came here, I hated you people." And around the congregation, heads were nodding everywhere. "But something happened to me," Jake said, "and I don't understand this, but tonight I love you." And the writer describes how even though Jake only had one tooth, this smile spread across his whole face. Because wonderfully, as we get caught up into this eternal relationship with the Father and the Son, we find something happens. There's this new love. There's this new oneness with others in God's family. And next, Jesus goes on to explain something of how this happens, the mechanism of how this kind of transformation occurs, and especially how this can grow and grow within us. I wonder if you've thought about this question of how it is that human beings change. I guess if we're old enough and we're self-aware enough, and we've probably discovered that real change in life is a lot harder than just turning over a new leaf, or just, you know, resolve, making a new resolution. Perhaps there's things in our life we'd love to change. There's a bitterness maybe we'd love to let go of, or there's a habit and it's just too strong, we think, to break. And actually, if we've discovered that in our lives, that is a brilliant first step, really. The Bible does teach in lots of places about this inability we have to change ourselves. It's definitely true. And that's why it's so exciting to learn here from Jesus how it is that with God's help, we really can break through and find real change in our lives. And that's our next point, because Jesus wants his followers to be united in love. That was point one. So that, or by rather, experiencing the glory of God's love. And that's sounds a bit like Christian jargon, but I'm going to hopefully explain what I mean by that. So here, Jesus explains how real change can happen. Look with me at verse 22. It's on the screens if you want. It says this: "The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we, Father and Son, are one." Isn't this wonderful? The way this transformation happens, Jesus says, is through Jesus revealing God's glory to us. If you were here a couple of weeks ago, we were thinking about this whole topic of glory in the Bible. And we looked at the passage where Moses asks to see God's glory. And there's this tension because God says, "You can't see my glory and live." And We thought about how Moses had to hide in a rock, and God came and declared his name to Moses. And he declared, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And then, and we didn't actually get onto the next bit, where we didn't touch on this last time, but after the Lord speaks to Moses and after he renews the covenant with the people, Moses then comes down the mountain and the people notice something. They notice that Moses' face is shining. And so Moses has to start wearing a veil to conceal the brightness of his face when he goes to see the people. And so what we discover is that this experience of glory that Moses has in Exodus has two big aspects to it, doesn't it? The first is that it's a revelation. So here's the glory, God's glory. And in particular, it is a revelation of God's holy love. Do you remember? Abounding in steadfast love. And then the second aspect we pick up from the text in Exodus 34 is that this revelation is a transforming experience. As Moses gazes on God's glory, something happens and he is changed as a result of it, and he shines. And John is picking up on all that imagery here in John 17. The way Jesus enables his community to be transformed into a people who are filled with love is by us first experiencing ourselves a transforming revelation of his love, discovering the love of God. Another way of saying this would be that human beings become like what we gaze upon, what we focus on. You may have seen this in all kinds of areas of life. I see it sometimes with preachers, certain preachers. Sometimes you can tell immediately which church they've spent a lot of time in because they start to adopt a certain person in that church's mannerisms, their turns of phrase, their tone. They've become like the one that they're focusing on. And it's the same sort of principle really with us and God, although at a much deeper level. That's how Paul describes it in 2 Corinthians 3. He says this, "And we all who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory." And Paul is deliberately, you can hear, can't you? He's picking up on the Exodus passage about Moses and about God's glory shining out and Moses' face glowing. And he says that is actually how we are changed as well. It's as we contemplate the Lord. It's as we focus on him. It's as we meditate on him that we end up becoming like him. So the first answer really to how it is that human beings can change, how it is that we can become part of this community of love, it is not actually firstly through willpower. It's not just through trying harder. Now, in order to change within, we need to gaze on Jesus. Or as verse 22 puts it, we need to experience his glory, the glory of his love. One person who understood this need for us to gaze on Jesus' glory was the 19th century Scottish minister, Robert Murray McChain. And I'm going to read now McChain's advice for how it is someone can make progress in the Christian life, how they can grow and change. He said this, "Learn much of the Lord Jesus. For every look at yourself, take 10 looks at Christ. He is altogether lovely. Live much in the smiles of God. Bask in his beams. Feel his all-seeing eyes settled on you in love and repose," or it means rest, "and rest in his almighty arms." So it's as we gaze on Jesus that this change happens and we start to become more and more like him. And then in verse 26, this idea gets taken even further. So look with me, verse 26, an incredible verse really. I made known to them your name, Jesus says. It's actually very similar, isn't it, to Exodus, where Moses has God's name revealed to him. I made known to them your name, and I will continue to make it known, that the love with which you have loved me may be in them, and I in them. So Jesus' intention is not simply that we kind of see this vision from a distance. You know, this we get a picture of what God's love could be like. Jesus' aim for us is that we receive this love into ourselves, and that we know the Father's love in experience. A bit like the lion cub feels his Father's care in experience. There's a place at the beginning of John's Gospel, John 1:18, where in the original it says, Jesus has eternally been in the bosom of, or in the lap of, the Father. The Father has always loved and delighted in his Son. Before Jesus does anything in his ministry, the Father declares over him, you'll remember at his baptism, that's my boy. That's the one. Look at him. You are my dearly loved son. I'm so thrilled with you. And now we discover in verse 26 and in verse 23, and there's no way I would ever presume to say this except Jesus says it first. Jesus says that that love, the love that the Father has always had for the Son, that is the love that he has for you and for me. You see, Jesus is offering us something so rich and so wonderful here that we can scarcely take it in. And the more we receive, the more we grasp this love, the more it will change us at the deepest level, and it will start to flow out from us. Just at a human level, receiving love makes a huge difference to someone. If we're fortunate enough to have been loved by human parents, it does change us. It gives us a stability. It gives us an anchor that we carry with us throughout our lives. Or when a woman gets proposed to, it lifts her whole demeanour, doesn't it? For about a month, it seems. You can just see it from 10 paces. She's just different because of it. And yet, how much more does it impact us when the one in the whole universe, whose opinion counts more than any other, when he declares his love over us, like here. When I was at the Barge Church, I was only allowed a Lord of the Rings quote once every 6 months, and I think it's probably been that long, so it's about time for another one. And there's a place in Tolkien's Two Towers where Faramir is being complimented by Sam Gamgee, and because Faramir esteems Sam very highly, Sam's approval means a whole big deal to him. And he says these words, they're beautiful words. He says this: the praise of the praiseworthy is above all rewards. The praise of the praiseworthy is above all rewards. It's as we receive approval and praise and love from the one who is utterly praiseworthy, from God himself, that we are changed. And we're enabled to love others. So Christian growth is a lot less like learning a script, and it's a lot more like, I think, being part of one of these champagne fountains we're about to see. And I'm going to pause now, and we're going to watch a little clip of an illustration the girls have been helping me with, trying to capture something of how God's love flows into us and then overflows from us. So let's watch that. I sometimes say, if I'm speaking at a wedding, that the key for each of the partners to loving one another well is being constantly replenished with love from God. And I think it's true for any relationship. The key to us loving one another here at Grace Church is each of us constantly coming back to the Father and receiving his love afresh each day. And this process of experiencing the glory of God's love, because it is a process, is why the unity which we're called to as a church is a unity which we're constantly to pursue more and more each day. We get that in verse 23, I in them and you in me, that they may become perfectly one. And that includes not just those in our fellowship, although definitely it starts there, but pursuing a unity with all true believers. And we began with how the question of global unity can be achieved. The world that we all want, this united world. And Jesus says that wonderfully this process will one day be complete. Jesus' plans for global unity will be achieved. Look at verse 24. Jesus says this, Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am to see my glory. The glory that you have given me because you loved me before the foundation of the world. Now, in the days of Jesus' flesh, when he was on earth, Jesus did reveal the Father's glory, but it was a strange glory. It was a veiled glory. It was a glory which a lot of people missed. And yet Jesus says there is a day coming when all of Jesus' people will see his unveiled glory. We will see the glory that he shared with the Father before creation. And as John explains elsewhere, actually this is in his letter, 1 John chapter 3, but we know that when he, that is Christ, appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. This is the Christian's great hope, that there's a future ahead of us of seeing Jesus' glory. And then as we see it, of course, we'll be transformed to be like him. And that's why on that day, the whole world is going to be renewed. It'll be a world of perfect harmony, beyond even John Lennon's wildest imaginings. It's going to be a world of perfect love and perfect and deep unity amongst us. And yet whilst we wait for that day, we have a calling. And our calling is to display such a love, such a unity, that more and more people want to come in and be a part of it. And they want to get in on it. And that brings us to our final point. Jesus wants his followers to be united in love. But then how do we become that kind of community? That's point two. Well, by experiencing the glory of God's love. And then the final point there. Point three, so that the world may believe. If you were with us last week, we were considering how Jesus' words were divine words. They were words first spoken between the Father and the Son in heaven. And we saw how Jesus entrusted these incredible words to his followers, the 11. And the 11 then passed these words on so that the world can then receive these life-giving words that we desperately need. And I said then, it's a little bit like a relay race where these life-giving words get passed down the line. And one question which came up, we had a Q&A afterwards, was, well, what place does Christian community have in this great plan? And at the time, I wasn't just pausing for time. I said, come back next week and we'll touch on that, because I knew these verses were coming up. And that's what we're going to think about now, because in these verses we discover what a vital place the church, and in particular Christian love, has in God's purposes for his world. So let's read again from verse 22. So I'll pick up before the bit on the screen. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may become perfectly one. And then what's the final outbox of all this? So that the world may know that you sent me and love them even as you loved me. Christian love and unity are actually vital to the church's mission in the world. In fact, our love amongst us, our unity, is actually to be so strange, so inexplicable by normal human categories, that the only explanation is by looking to Jesus to explain it. So our mission in the world is not simply to pass on a message. It's not simply to proclaim a truth. or to show that our worldview is coherent and persuasive. Our mission is to say, come on in, come and have a look, come and experience what we have discovered in Christ. Someone said that the church's calling is a little bit like being one of those show homes. That there's always, well, often it, when a big development's happening, one home gets built before all the others, and it's meant to be so you could go and look at it and see what eventually the whole development is going to be like. And God's purpose is that people should look at the church, they should look at us at Grace Church, and they should say, wow, whew, that is what the future is going to be like. This community of love and truth and forgiveness. I could really get on board with this. I'm in. And looking back at history, this has often been the pattern of how the church has grown. The Oxford professor E.R. Dodds, he wasn't himself a Christian, he wrote that genuine love and unity amongst the early Christians was a major cause, perhaps the strongest single cause, of the spread of Christianity. And especially, of course, through the plagues. This is quite topical for us, because in the second and third centuries, over about 100 years, about a third of the population of the empire was wiped out in the Roman Empire, and everyone fled the cities, including the doctors. But of course, the Christians stayed, and they cared not only for their own sick, but also for others who had been abandoned by their families. And people could see the difference Christian fellowship made in practice, and they wanted in on it. I mentioned in the Q&A last week how big an emphasis Christian love, Christian community is in the church's mission, especially in John's writings. And I mentioned last week how God is invisible, and therefore the question we are faced with is how, or you know, where in the world could we go to experience and encounter God? And the answer to that question actually depends on when exactly in human history you live. In the first chapter of John's Gospel, John writes this: no one has ever seen God. There's the issue, God is invisible, but don't worry, the one and only Son, Jesus, who is himself God, has made him known. So the place to go and encounter God, John says, is Jesus. Jesus has solved the problem. He's made the invisible God visible. But what about now, John? What about when Jesus has returned to heaven? Well, John answers again, and this time in his letter, 1 John 4, verse 12, where the same writer, he puts it like this: no one has ever seen God. It's exactly the same phrase. But if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. So do you see the point? The first answer to where someone can go to encounter God is go to Jesus. Look at him. He's the one who makes the invisible Father visible. And now he's gone back to the Father. The best place to encounter God and find Jesus is, well, here, where Christians are loving one another. That's what displays the reality of God to a watching world. And when you hear stories, we could share some stories probably between us of how it is we first came to have Christian faith. Very often, those stories begin with the life of another Christian, which catches our attention. I won't do a show of hands, but I wonder how many of us who are believers could say, yes, that is what happened to me. There was a person or people who were just different, and they had a quality of life that was intriguing, and they loved in a way that I hadn't seen before. And I could see they had something I didn't, and I just wanted to find out. Andy Crouch, who's a Christian author, and he writes for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, earlier this month, he said this: at this extraordinary moment, we have perhaps the greatest opportunity to make a difference than we've ever had. And he said this: we need as a church to redirect social energy from anxiety and panic to love and preparation. This crisis presents an extraordinary opportunity to fortify small communities of love and care for our neighbours. Now, I think sometimes when we hear this incredible calling Jesus has for us as his church, the calling is so high that sometimes it just feels too far away. We feel sometimes even discouraged by it. And we're very aware of, you know, the problems in ourselves and in those around us, that we forget that actually when other people come in and are amongst us, they do really experience something extraordinary. And we forget that they find a quality of relationship that you cannot find elsewhere. Even in the last couple of weeks, in fact, especially I think in the last couple of weeks, it's been wonderful to see around Grace Church that the sort of stuff that Andy Crouch is calling us to, how people have been looking out for, reaching out for one another. Some of you have been doing shopping for those who can't. Some of you have been offering to have others live with you who might otherwise be lonely. Some of you, at least before the lockdown, I know, have been dropping notes at all the houses down your street asking if you can be a help to any of your neighbours. And I regularly hear stories within Grace Church of how somebody, how touched somebody has been by the way folk, usually within their small group, have walked with them through all kinds of hard times. And please, if you're not yet in a small group, why not sign up today? This is the best place to be to experience deeper relationships and to experience what I'm talking about. Or someone else has said how impressed their family were by the way Christians in this church had given up their time to help them move house. You see, this kind of love, which can seem ordinary, is actually very powerful and very striking to someone who's looking in. So I guess one of the encouragements for us from these verses is for us not to hide what the Lord is doing amongst us. I guess sometimes we feel nervous about mixing up our friendship groups, you know, mix up our work friends and our church friends. Perhaps that's one for after the lockdowns are over. Not very sensible right now, perhaps. Or we feel nervous inviting people to church stuff, and because, you know, we're convinced they're going to find it weird. Actually, that is something that we can do even during the lockdown, because especially now, people online can peek around the door of the church without ever leaving their living room, so it's easier to wander in. And actually, people are often very hungry right now for community and might be more open. And of course, people are going to find church a bit weird, but that's okay. It's good weird. And ordinarily, London is full of proximity without real intimacy. And so when people recognise real love, and when they see it, it really makes a difference and it stands out a mile. And often that is the thing, isn't it, which hits people between the eyes that when we first encounter Christian fellowship. It's very powerful. So as we close, some people have been wondering what will be the long-term effects of the virus on Christian fellowship. It's been suggested, some people have said, that taking church online will mean we will develop a taste for streaming services and will dispense with church gatherings altogether. I'm actually very confident about the opposite. And now, I don't want to be glib, but I don't want to downplay the challenge it is to be part of Christian community sometimes. I don't want to downplay the spiritual battle involved, all these forces trying to pull us away from church sometimes. But I am quietly confident that this time of absence will actually be good for us, and it'll ignite our excitement really about physical church gatherings when things finally back to normal. It's a bit like lovers who are parted by war and forced only to write letters to one another. When that happens, it's pretty unusual when peacetime comes for them to decide to say, well, let's just stick with the letters, shall we? You know, that seemed to be working well. No, as that toothless guy, Jake, discovered, God has done something incredible. He's joined us together. into one family, and it's a wonderful miracle. And yes, we have been forced apart for a while, but even as we're apart, let's keep reaching out, keep caring for one another, and keep longing actually for that day when our gatherings are back to normal. And especially, let's be those who are longing beyond that for the day when Jesus promises, when there will be a world of perfect unity. And in the meantime, let's be doing all we can to get behind Jesus' great purpose for his world. Let's receive his love in our lives day by day, and then let's make sure that this love spills over to others, a bit like that champagne fountain, and also that the world might be drawn in. Thank you.